Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast all about wildlife facts, conservation updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. Before I move on to today's show, I'd like to start with a little bit of an announcement. Into the Wild and myself is extremely excited to announce that we have started our first ever partnership with Leica Sport Optics. I feel incredibly lucky that this is with a brand that I am personally passionate about and stands for what Into the Wild does as well, and that's bringing people closer to nature. Born in Germany, Leica products are the creation of over 100 years of knowledge in developing and manufacturing optical systems. Leica's quest? Simple. Creating awareness and bringing people closer to the wonders of nature. In an era of increasingly threatened wilderness, Leica serve those who treasure it by promising and delivering the ability to see wildlife as you've never seen it before. With Christmas just around the corner, why not treat yourself, or the nature enthusiast you love, to a pair of Leica UltraVid BR binoculars. These fully waterproof, compact binoculars are unequalled in size, fitting perfectly into your jacket pocket, whilst offering the same resolution and sharpness as their full-size sibling. The link to these binoculars can be found in the write-up of this episode. And now, on with the show. We all watch nature shows on TV, right? Surely you must. And these shows always have a face, a voice, a person, telling us the information we need to fully understand what we are seeing. But how hard is that? Being that person, I mean, both behind and in front of the screen. Well, on today's show, and the last episode of 2020, I talked to Spring and Autumn Watch presenter, biologist, voiceover artist, producer, newly appointed Vice President of the Wildlife Trust, and a mother, Gillian Burke. It was, as always, a pleasure to chat and to hear about Gillian's career and her memories of where it's taken her. Her message? It's simple. Be yourself and slow down. We talk about the pressure of being a presenter, Gillian's favourite invertebrates, a close-up with a grey seal, and her new role at the Wildlife Trust and what she hopes for the future. I also have a message at the end of this episode, being the last one of the year and all, so please stay tuned for that. But for now, thanks for tuning in and enjoy the show. Gillian, welcome to Into the Wild. Can I just say it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show, and it's going to be the last show of the year and the series for us, so this is like a finale. That's how I'm treating it. But hello and welcome. How are you?
Well, thank you, first of all, for inviting me onto your podcast. I am, I don't know, do you want the official version? It's 2020, right?
Go, what, go with the official answer.
I'm good.
I'm fine, I think is the standard.
Yes, I'm fine. That's a win in this year, right?
Could not agree more when people are asking you. I'm fed up with saying, oh, you know, all things considered, I'm fine. Yeah.
No, but yeah, definitely grateful.
For the listeners that live under a rock, a question that we still ask everyone, would you like to start by telling us who you are and what is it you do?
Listeners under a rock. That's very kind. Do you know what? There are a lot of people, most people, I would say, you know, just kind of go, who are you? Anyway, never mind. My name is Gillian Burke. I am a biologist. And I do a lot of things, so I feel like a bit of a hustler sometimes. But the main things I do is I'm a biologist and a presenter on BBC Spring Watch and Autumn Watch and Winter Watch. So that's probably, if anyone knows who I am, that's probably where they know. But I do plenty of other stuff. I'm a writer as well. And I do voiceovers and I'm a mom. So yeah, lots of hats. I put that one last, but let's face that is like...
How do your children feel about you putting that one last?
You know what? They never listen to anything I do or watch anything I do, so I can say whatever I want.
Oh, before I forget, I look after these children.
Yeah, they are in my care.
Yeah. So the second question we go with all our guests, and I really enjoy asking this one, is... How and when did your love for wildlife and nature begin for you?
Yes. Okay. So This is a great question. It's one I get asked a lot. It's one I think we ask of everyone nowadays, particularly in 2020 when we've started to notice nature so much more. I say we, I'm talking very generally, obviously.
Yeah.
I was born in Kenya and I grew up in Kenya I lived there until I was 10 years old.
Oh, cool.
And so this is sort of mid 70s to early 80s. So I'm aging myself a little bit there. But you know, this is like the days before the internet, we can cast our minds back to that time. And it was the days before daytime telly. You know, I remember getting our first colour TV. You know, that was like seriously exciting.
Are you telling me Richard and Judy weren't always on TV?
I hate to break it to you. No, honestly, like, so we had this thing when we first started, had TV, that TV would go off air at 7 o'clock so people could go and have dinner together. And then they would come back on air at 8 o'clock. Play the national anthem and everyone would like gather around to watch, I don't know, Dallas or Dynasty or whatever. It was, you know, that was how it was. So connecting with nature or loving nature wasn't something I had to actively do. It was actually the default setting, particularly where I lived. I lived right on the outskirts of Nairobi. So our family home was in a new housing estate that had been built on a former coffee plantation. So it wasn't like growing up I wasn't sort of in the bush in a savannah, you know, like riding elephants or something like that. It was pretty sort of, it wasn't quite suburban either. It was just pretty normal. But what I did have was a lot of time, a lot of outdoors, and a lot of freedom. So what I spent most of my days, if I wasn't in school, doing was just being outside, because that's what we had to do. It was like, you're not meant to be indoors during the day. You get shooed outside by, you know, the grown-ups, because they're like, you're just going to make a mess. You're just going to get in the way. Go outside. And that's what we did.
Yeah.
So it was just a normal and everyday thing.
That's really interesting, like you said about, like, the, you know, entertainment-wise, apart from nature, it was create your own. And obviously that, and meant going outside. So I guess that's such a, when I say obvious, I mean that in a great way, an obvious answer for some people that have said, well, we had nothing else, it was nature, and we kind of connected with that. And that's obviously a clear reason why some people don't now, I think.
And you know what, it's not anyone's fault, in my opinion, if they're not outside connecting with nature. I mean, I tell this story partly because I know it makes me sound really ancient and I feel so like, oh God, in the olden days. But honestly, it does sound like that, doesn't it? You can be honest.
I'll say it in a minute too, don't worry.
But you're being very polite. But I make the point in sort of embarrassing myself and aging myself, because it's important to note that that's not the norm anymore. And so I feel like sometimes, and I've been so guilty of this, like, oh, go out, connect with nature, be outdoors. And actually the distractions and the technology and the algorithms make it so that actually it's really hard. It's really hard to resist all the distractions now, and particularly for kids and teenagers. And I just think, you know, frankly, I was going to say you don't have a hope in hell. You do have hope. We always have hope. But it's hard. It really is hard. So I don't say, like I said, I say it because I'm trying to make the point that that's not normal anymore. And we need to look at that. Personally, I think that's a real, like, almost criminal that we've allowed society to get like that. And that is everywhere, not just in, you know, Britain and Europe and the States. It's when I go back to Kenya with my kids, they're teenagers now, but I see that too. I see a lot of kids, you know, very much on devices, and it's so ubiquitous. So,
I think it's become a fake reliance, isn't it? It's made to feel like we're reliant on it, where really, when you step away from it, you realize, actually, I'm fine. I am fine without it, and I'm not. It's not food. It's not oxygen. It's not water. You can go a substantial amount of time without it. And I'm going to use the phrase now, as I promised I just did. When I was younger, back in the day, even I didn't have devices. I didn't have devices. We played outside. We were outside, you know, every day of summer holidays. We never, and like you said, my mum would be like, would you go out? Maybe we had a games console if we were lucky, but that was, you know, really not something that was common in every household. So I agree even then, but I've seen that slow change come in, and even talking to myself where I've spent more time on the phone from work purposes, from social, from entertainment, everything. And it's become this, like I said, a fake reliance, I guess. Now we're going to talk about a bit on that, I guess. We're going to talk about a bit about your TV work. That's kind of nice segue, didn't I? talking of screens.
Hello, everybody.
You've been involved with producing natural history TV programs for some time. How do you go around this job? Because I feel that's quite a technical and quite a, I don't know, important job. Like we just said, people need that nature fix. How do you go around figuring out what is best to put out there on TV screens?
Okay, so let me just start by saying that I struggle with the knowledge that I am using the very technology that I think actually disconnects us to try and get people connected. Trust me, that one.
Let's recognize the irony.
By the way, that's how I pay my rent as well, feed my children. So, just saying, the irony has not been lost on me. So how do I go about like doing it? It's that's a lovely question, because it's actually the best part of the job as far as I'm concerned. I started off I started off doing work experience. So I had my biology degree, you know, that was, I didn't realize, but that was my ticket into the industry. I did biology thinking I was going to do something else. I thought I was going to do research. Discovered I was like the laziest scientist in the world. So I realized that, you know, out of respect for the scientific process, I should do something else. So I kind of got my bachelor's and left after a year of trying to do a PhD. So then I sort of stumbled around thinking, well, what am I going to do? And figured out eventually that, I'm in Bristol and there's this place where they make these natural history programs. That's the NHU, the Natural History Unit, the BBC. So did work experience there for a very long time. And then eventually got my first researcher's job. And the industry is such that, you know, that's your entry into natural history if you want to be making those films, is you start off as a researcher. And I always feel like it's a shame because you kind of try and blow past being a researcher as quickly as possible, partly because it's poorly paid. Yeah. And you get to assistant producer and then you're kind of on your way and then you get to direct and produce, which is all great stuff. But I genuinely still look back on the days when I was researching and think that was the best time.
Because really?
That's when I got to read, I got to read just journals and articles and scientific papers, which, to be honest, during my degree, I found really, really boring and, you know, impenetrable. It was painful. I had to make myself do it in order to get through the degree. But what I realize now is I didn't really know why I was reading that stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas as soon as I started working as a researcher, I had a purpose. And my purpose was like, this is really cool stuff. It's really interesting. Right now, I don't know how many people would find it interesting in its current form because it has to be presented in this way in the scientific paper. But what I want to do is try and make, like, I don't know, a 9-year-old really, really just like riff on how amazing spiders are. And this is why, because of they do X, Y, Z, you know, and I just loved it. So to me, I saw it as this challenge of, can I take this information and go back and get my flatmates excited about it? Because none of them were into nature. None of them were into biology, or actually that's unfair, one was, but so that was, for me, that was the challenge. It's like, how, you know, can I do this? Can I make someone who really actually thinks this is dull and nerdy, like, excited and just go, wow, I didn't know that. So that was kind of, and I still think that is what I'm still trying to do, you know, with a different hat on now.
Yeah.
But yeah, researching was the best bit. And the best bit about it was I got to call up, this is again, oh my God, I'm so old. These are the days when you would like send a fax or a letter to somebody. just about had emails, but it still felt rude to just drop an email to someone out of the blue. So you'd sort of send a fax. It felt a bit more official. You need to see a signature, someone's, you know, like evidence that this is a real human. And then you would make a plan and you would phone them on the telephone and just have a good old fashioned phone call. And you might guess I like talking. So it was brilliant. I got to talk loads and listen loads to really amazing people, people who were, some of whom were famous in their field, some of whom weren't, but just all had interesting stuff to say. And that was my job. That's what I got paid to do.
I feel like I'm having that job now. I really feel from a someone that is, and you know, not blowing my own, but you know, creating a podcast, the people I get to chat to, this is the best part of the job, when I just get to connect. So I feel like everything you've just said, I'm like, that's the best part of it. It truly is. Since all that, you've now moved in front of the camera. You were, you know, someone that was working behind, producing all this. You're now in front of the camera for, like you said at the beginning, BBC's Spring Watch and its spin-off shows throughout the year. Now, I thought, I don't know if this is true, but I'm kind of basing this on my experience from being a presenter on stage and talking about animals. But do you feel like the pressure to learn more about nature now you're in front of the camera has grown? As in, do you feel like you need to be more of the expert?
I'm really, yeah, this is only a question that someone who's been there would know to ask. Because yes, there is pressure to be an expert. And I really, oh my gosh, like one of the things that really bugs me is I keep seeing kind of, you know, like there might be, an article or some reference to me and it's Gillian Burke, naturalist. And I go, oh my God, no, I'm not a naturalist. I'm really not a naturalist. You know, I did biology a long time ago, but I'm not, you know, okay, first of all, let's just deal with that. I'm not a naturalist. And that's a very specific discipline and field and skill that is almost always, I think, the best naturalists acquire their knowledge in the field, out in the living, breathing world, not from books. I mean, field guides and books will help. Definitely. But naturalists, I just bow to that sort of what I consider to be a whole different way of relating to the natural world that I have never really had that. Like I spent a lot of time outdoors as a child in nature, but I didn't have access to field guides and I wasn't really in a kind of culture where there was this thing of like, we're going to find out what everything's called and we're going to, you know, draw it or name it or whatever, you know. It was a whole different way of relating to it. So by the time I started presenting, I didn't realize that that was something that was gonna, that pressure would, it wasn't so much that the pressure was placed on me. It was that there was an assumption that I had arrived in this role via the same route as everybody else. And it has taken me quite a long time to work out what's going on, because the immediate feeling was, oh my God, I've got to learn like this whole new way of relating to the natural world that I never really did, and there's this huge pressure. So once I kind of just said, whoa, hang on a second, you know, I know that my experiences are valid and true in terms of the way I think of the world, the way I've learned about the world and how I feel about it. You know, so let's just start with that. Like, there's nothing wrong with the way I relate to the natural world. It's just different. So I have had to, I mean, I still feel like, for example, I didn't grow up in Britain. I came here as an adult. So I always describe the experience of being out in nature as kind of speaking a second language. So, you know, and again, it's taken me a long time to work this out, because the first feeling was just panic. Oh my gosh, I don't know the stuff that everyone knows around me. I don't talk about nature the way everyone talks about nature when I go to a nature reserve, if I join like, you know, an outing like a BioBlitz or something. And it did make me feel, I guess, the imposter syndrome really sort of like landed hard when I started to think that. But I think what I've had to really slow down and think, okay, what is going on here? Why do I feel like this? And let's just get to the bottom of it. And so some of the things I think is, like I said, you know, for me, the experience of being like in, you know, talking and being a British nature is like talking a second language. I'm passionate about it. I deeply care about it, but it is a second language. Mm-hmm. I didn't grow up here. So I have to work just that little bit harder to recognize what I'm looking at. You know, the search images aren't sort of ingrained in the same way that when I go back to Kenya, like the irony is because I left when I was 10, I don't have the names, but the search images of what I'm looking at, boom, immediately. Mm. Like I can look at what I call a monkey nut tree from a distance, and I will know exactly what it smells like if I crush the leaves or if I scratch, there's like a furry casing around the seeds. If I scratch that off, I know what that feels like. I don't even have to touch the tree. I know
you
that.
You just know.
So that's what I mean. That's my first language. That's my mother tongue in terms of my natural history knowledge. And everything else is like a second language. So I'm very proficient and fluent in it, but I have to work that little bit harder.
And
I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, that does. But I think what your answer there for me, and I'm sure the listeners that are listening now, highlights the importance of having a range of people from not just backgrounds and countries, but also a range of knowledge, because it doesn't get that bias, I guess, of like every science or nature person has to be white lab coat, glasses, expert, knows all the Latin names. When I watched that as TV when I was a child, I would remember going, I don't learn like that, I'm never going to know this, but I enjoy watching it and trying to learn. But having a more diverse group of knowledge, as well as, you know, backgrounds, cultures and everything on TV, really helps get more people in, I would imagine. So everything you've just said there, I'm like, that's why we need presenters like this that learn in different ways, for you to know that, you know, I've got to understand this information in this way so I can present it in a way that I know other people will understand as well.
Totally. And, you know, the interesting thing for me is that it's taken me a while to understand that for myself. You know, like I would obviously naturally believe that representation and diversity across like all platforms and all subjects is important.
Yeah.
Just because of who I am, you know, but I just feel in doing the job and having to kind of go through what I would consider like the awkward and really hard sort of beginning of, you know, settling into the role and becoming comfortable with the role. The process of getting there has made me appreciate that in a way that I don't know if anyone else has ever articulated it in that same way, because that is literally just my personal and unique experience of, oh, this is why sometimes I don't feel like I'm in the club. Mm. It's not because people are being unfriendly necessarily. People are often very welcoming. It's not because, you know, it's like really subtle and it takes time. And I think this is what maybe gets lost in a lot of dialogue around, you know, more diversity and more representation in the conservation sector and the environmental sector. It's actually, you know, by giving people opportunities, it gives them the time to figure out, like, what am I bringing to the table?
Mm.
You know, and how can I tell stories differently? Because I don't know about you when you've been presenting, but there is definitely a temptation to sort of, you know, kind of fit a mold because you think, well, that works, I'll do a bit more of that.
Yeah.
And also just, it's just human nature. You start to, even without meaning to, mimic and conform to what's around you.
Yeah.
So it takes like a conscious and active effort, it's work, to constantly go reappraise what I'm doing. Why am I talking like that? Honestly, like sometimes I very rarely watch myself back, but especially the early stuff. Holy crap. I'm like, why was I talking like that? That's not even how I sound.
I empathize with that.
Yeah. So I just think, I think that's me sort of feeling very insecure and uncertain of why I'm there and what I'm doing and, you know, all of that. And man, it's like, it's so painful. Painful. I feel sorry for everyone who has to watch it. Sorry, everyone.
But that's part of it. Like you said, though, we're so used to watching something in a certain way. I would say across most industries, not just media. This could be a job being done in a certain way, or, you know, the way things are worked, politicians or anything. that we conform to that thinking that's how it should be done. However, what we always seem to lack, and this has got better in the last 10 years, is individuality in whatever the job role is. So creating, like, remembering, just be yourself. People, if you're passionate about this, let's focus back onto nature and conservation as a presenter. If you're just being yourself, I come from a background which is a bit sweary. Like, I grew up in very Cockney London, and it's ingrained in me. I try and keep it out of the podcast. But on my social media, I blur it out, but I try and bring that in a bit, because I'm like, it's me. If I didn't put that in, I just wouldn't be myself. And some people would have certain thoughts of that. I just don't want to restrict myself. And I'm sure you've probably felt that in many ways, of just let yourself come out into the job.
Yeah, I know about the sweary thing, definitely. really scary on live TV.
Yeah, oh God, yeah, yeah.
Family, you know, family viewing. no, I couldn't agree with that more. I think you may relate to this as well, but, you know, I guess that's the learning, that being yourself is actually very difficult.
Yeah.
Because I think you have to know yourself really well.
Mm.
And I feel like, yeah, you know, that's been one of the beautiful things about the sort of journey, you know, crossing that very, very short journey from behind the camera to in front of the camera. you know, I've had to really do a lot of sort of, you know, introspection, and just to get to the point where I'm going, oh, right, I just need to be myself. Because I just was never certain of, like, what was being expected of me, especially joining such an established brand. Mm. I sometimes wonder if I had a different entry into it, whether something, you know, how it would have played out. But actually, in some ways, you know, joining such an established brand, I think, gave me, it was like just a supercharged experience of having to step into a role that has like a public profile and their expectations, and it's an established brand and they have their way of doing things and the audience are loyal and they know what they like and they like what they know and all that sort of stuff, you know. And I respect that, you know. I'm not here to kind of reinvent the wheel, but I definitely feel like the more I'm starting to understand what it is I can bring that's different.
Yeah.
And actually, it's not even what I can bring. It's just like, oh, I just need to be me.
Yeah.
A bit more.
Yes, exactly. It's like a full circle. We do it all the time. Go, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? Oh, you just be yourself and just don't swear.
Yeah. yeah.
We've kind of touched on it a bit here, but I was going to be talking about a bit of the challenges in the nature industry in regards to a very broad spectrum, but about getting into it, because it's very competitive and a very demanding industry, especially now, I think, from a demand point of view. But what are some of the challenges you faced in your career, would you say, that, I don't know if there's any aspiring people listening, just to be aware or prepared for?
So I think it's so different now to when I started. I mean, the main challenge when I started was there were still relatively few places that were making natural history.
Yeah.
Certainly in Britain, it was Bristol, it was a natural history unit, and like a handful of independent production companies. And that changed, you know, quite quickly once I started, in that we started producing more, we as in the Bristol kind of, you know, posse, started producing more and more stuff for American broadcasters like Discovery Channel and National Geographic. So that was really exciting.
Mm.
So those are the challenges. It was more just, you know, there was not many places to go with it.
Mm.
Other challenges were, well, actually, like I hinted earlier, like, you know, having to do a lot of work experience and just juggling that, you know, with how do I actually pay my rent? And for a long time, I actually, you know, just did a lot of sofa surfing and bunking on floors of friends' houses. You know, we all did it.
Yeah.
Until we kind of found our feet. And I think, you know, in some ways, you know, those are fun times. So actually, I'm glad I had them. So they're challenging, but fun. And then, yeah, you know, to be honest, I never really stopped to think a lot in those days. Mm. I was like, you know, just go after this, go after that. I never saw myself as a particularly ambitious person or someone who was like super competitive. I genuinely tried to only work on things that I really cared about.
Yeah.
I got lucky, I suppose, in that I cared about things that maybe a lot of people weren't even looking at. So I loved invertebrates. I still do. It's like, you know, I love them, yeah. Right? So I found myself working on stuff like, you know, about ants, about spiders, snakes, which I know are vertebrates. They have a backbone, but yeah. Know, they're still like the creepy crawly
stuff.
They're
the non-loved vertebrae.
Yeah. So actually, now that I think about it, that was probably my ticket, was that I was really, really into that. It wasn't just I was willing to do it, I was really into it.
Yeah.
And most other people wanted to be like, I want to work, you know, film whales and I want to go film lions. I was like, yeah, that's cool. I'll do that. Someone pays me. But I'm really like, I will sit in a lab or in a dark studio for weeks on end, like trying to film like a leaf cutter ant colony. And, you know, I was really happy doing that.
Yeah.
So in some ways that just kind of worked, because I became kind of known as the person that did all these. Like if there was ever an insect or spiders or worms or anything that nobody else wanted to work on, like, oh, Johnny will do that. So maybe that's the secret.
Get niche quick. Yeah. In that case, I've got to ask you, what's your favorite invertebrate? You've got to have one.
My favorite invertebrate. Well, spiders, definitely.
Spiders. Oh, yeah.
I like ants and social insects too. I find worms, I need to learn so much more about them, but the more I delve into that, I'm just like, what the hell is going on there?
I have a love for worms that I consider unhealthy because I can't walk past a worm on a pavement without moving it on the grass, which increases my time too much. I consider it unhealthy. So if you've got any advice on, just tell me they're fine on the path and that would help.
You heard it here first, folks, okay? you know, I'm like that with snails.
Yes.
I know like they're the bane of every gardener's life, but man, like that feeling when mm-hmm. you like step out in the dark and you feel it underfoot and it goes crunch.
Yep.
Ugh, like everything in me just like shrivels.
Mm.
Probably not as much as a snail, but so I hate that.
Yeah.
I hate that. So I don't know what to say to you other than just do what you do. Yeah. Loving your work.
I think like that sound of crushing the snail, which we dread, it's the equivalent of hearing My Heart Will Go On in the late 90s. Like it just got your, you would just get that punch. You're like, oh, I got it. That's it. I've got to get through that now.
Yeah.
Right. We need to talk about nature some more as well. We're on a nature podcast. Right. Okay. What has been, would you say, your most memorable nature or wildlife experience?
Wow. Okay. So I can do like on the watches and then just everything else. Mm. Oh my gosh. Like how long do you have?
How long do you have?
I know I should pick one. Can I just do my favorite top like three?
Okay. Yeah, go for it.
So on the watches, top three are in third place, blue sharks, swimming in blue sharks.
Oh,
just
wow.
Amazing. Mm. Just amazing. Then the sea, I had this encounter with gray seals. I see them a lot in Cornwall where I live, you know, so I felt like really familiar and I wasn't really expecting any great shakes, but this seal encounter, which was filmed, so we were in the water, I must stress that, like trying to get close to seals when they're hauled out on land is a massive no-no.
Yeah,
they are so sensitive to human disturbance, it's massively stressful for them. So that's my PSA. But in the water, if they approach you, that's on their terms.
Mm.
They choose how close they're going to come. They are supremely adapted to that environment. They know that they're faster, they feel safer, yeah. All that sort of stuff. So I was a silly, went up to film this area just near kind of a reef, rocky reef break. And it's a known area where seals will come close to swimmers and surfers and stuff. And sure enough, they rocked up. And this one seal in particular was so curious that it sort of came right up to me. It kept sort of trying to hold my arm, like it was trying to like, you know, go arm in arm with me somewhere. It was the weirdest thing. I wasn't sure what it wanted.
You're in a Disney film or something.
Yeah, it was nuts. And then it eventually just muzzled right up against my mouth.
Oh my God.
You know, so I could feel its breath. I could see its teeth and its whiskers. At that point, I was like, well, you know, it's a bit late now to consider what could happen. And then off it swam, and that was that. But genuinely, I didn't feel threatened. And then what is still probably my top experience in the watches is filming the ladybird spiders. It was one of the first items I ever did.
Mm.
And having spent years as a researcher, you know, film researcher, traveled the world, sounds really corny but true, filming all kinds of spiders, meeting various arachnologists, and, you know, enthusiasts as well. I just knew that that was just one of those bucket list experiences for so many people. And I genuinely felt like I'm just not worthy almost of being the person to get to see this. So now that I'm here, I've just, you know, like I felt like I had to take every last detail in so that it was sort of like held for everyone else. It sounds a bit like big and fancy. I genuinely felt like that.
Yeah.
I actually, if I hadn't, they hadn't been filming, I possibly would have cried.
Really?
But like, I was like, I'm not crying on telly. Yeah. It's almost like that performance thing. Like, I was moved to tears. I was like, I'm not that person. But I was, you know, it was a cool experience. So those are my favorite on the watches. And then outside of that, I've just, will never forget filming king cobras. They are the most incredible creatures, like incredible. And then just personal experience was being around a waterhole. This is in Kenya, with, you know, just with my family camping and watching like this incredible scene unfold. It's like at nighttime, but there was enough light, moonlight, to see what was going on. And there was all sorts of animals. So it was actually a salt lake, not a waterhole. I must correct myself. And there was quite a lot of animals there. The sort of elephants moved in, chased off whatever animals were there. So they were kind of like running the show. And then this lone buffalo, clearly wounded, big old bull, limping. So for a wild animal to show they're in pain, they're like long past the point where they're in pain.
You know,
they would hide their pain. So it was clearly like almost certainly, you know, seeing his last days. But he had so much just attitude. And he could barely move, but he just fronted. And these like young bull elephants were like mock charging him and trying to like shoo him off. And he just stood his ground. And it was the most impressive thing I've ever seen.
Wow.
Of just... yeah, I didn't even know what it was. Was it courage? It was just beautiful to watch in the moonlight, you know. So that probably, as outside of my filming experience, that was probably my favorite thing. I feel like I learned so much just watching that unfold about holding your ground, standing your ground, I guess, you know.
Yeah. And just knowing like a bit of moment. Knowing a bit of what's going on in that moment. But God, that's a very powerful story of that buffalo. That's
well,
amazing.
You asked.
Yeah. I asked and wasn't prepared. That was amazing. Now I'm going to congratulate you here now, which I'm not sure if you'll like or not, but you've recently, as of, if I'm correct, in the last week or even a few days, you've been assigned Vice President of the Wildlife Trusts, which is amazing. Congratulations.
Yes, thank you. Sorry, I was trying. We're on a Zoom call here and I'm making faces, which is really silly, isn't it?
Yeah, Gillian shaking her head going, oh, I don't want to talk about it. But there's something
incredible. So the faces are like that combination of like disbelief, a little bit of like, pinch me, am I dreaming? Okay, first of all, when they asked me whether it was something I'd consider, I was just like, you know, yes, instantly. Because I have, at different points over the last 5+ years, I've been either a volunteer, so I volunteered for the Wildlife Trusts, and this is actually even before I started doing any, you know, the presenting work. I was just, you know, I really like what they do.
Yeah.
So I've been a volunteer, a member, reported quite a few stories now, you know, the watches of projects for the Wildlife Trust. I've written for them, I've written about them. I'm a huge admirer of all the people I've met on the grounds, you know, from the volunteers to the staff, to the kind of leadership people. like the whole organization, I just think is brilliant. Mm. So when they asked me, I was like, yeah, absolutely. You know, this is like genuinely like the biggest thing that's happened to me. And then when it was announced last week, what I wasn't expecting was how much reaction it got, like positive reaction. So slightly overwhelmed by that. So that's why I was making those faces just now. I thought I'd just quietly like become the vice president.
And absolutely like, not Gillian Burke, like, no.
I was like, oh my gosh, right, okay. So they announced that. And yeah, like I said, it's really cool. And this is like, well, there's no point like laboring the point, but you know, these are important times to be involved in the environmental sector. Mm-hmm. And even more than maybe being a nature person and into wildlife and a biologist, like I think I'm an environmentalist.
Yeah.
So for me, this is like, I just want to support what they do in whatever way I can to keep pushing things forward. I really feel like we can make some really big differences, like fundamental changes that need to be made if we're going to create like a future that is just serves everybody and exploits nobody and nothing. You know, I really believe that that's possible, because if I didn't believe it, and if we don't believe it, then it can't happen. So it has to start with at least believing it's possible, and just keep pushing through. So I don't really, like I said, I feel like I'm in service to them. I have ideas if they want any ideas, but I feel like they do an amazing job anyway. So like, you guys do what you do.
I'll sign here, I'll sign there.
But genuinely, like, you know, they're things that I would love to try and you know, be part of and collaborate. You know, it's a team effort. This isn't about being a hero in any way. It's like, I genuinely, on my bio, on my Instagram is, you know, working hard to make the world a better place so that I can kick back on a beach and have an earth-friendly beer on a plastic-free beach, I think I say, and stop working so hard. You
know? Yes. Yeah. I want to retire young. Completed it.
Well, you know, genuinely, I think all of us in this industry, like, you know, shouldn't our aim to be like redundant at some point soon?
Yeah, I agree.
In the sense that this isn't needed. We don't have to work so hard to keep a healthy and habitable planet. Mm-hmm. Be nice, right?
It would be more than nice. It would be so more than nice. But I mean, you know, I go on Twitter, I go on Instagram, you scroll through to see the daily news and you see, you know, I follow nature people on purpose, even if I wasn't doing this, because it's a positive way to have a positive experience on social media. And then when I saw the Wildlife Trust tweet that, I was like, you've smashed it. You've absolutely smashed it. And I'm not using that lightly. You've got Liz Bonin and yourself, two very established, wonderful people. And you just absolutely nailed that. And I just, for me, that was a real, and I'm sure my listeners will agree, I saw that tweet and I came away going, good, absolutely good. Because that is more than, that's the change we needed across this industry. And it's done with very little kind of, it's just done. It just got put out there again, this has happened, as is normal. And that's what I love the most about it.
Wow. Well, I'm going to be gracious enough and say just thank you. That means a lot. Thank you.
I'm going to, my penultimate question, I don't know if this is too cheeky to ask, but you said, obviously, the Wildlife Trust do wonderful things, and I couldn't agree with that statement more. But personally, what kind of things would you like to focus on or achieve with your work in the Wildlife Trust, although it's early days?
Oh, my gosh. Okay. This is like a Rolodex in my head.
I feel like an interviewee now. An interviewer, like, so what do you do?
I'm flipping through really quickly going, am I allowed to say that? No, probably not with that hat on. there's some things that I would love to see, but, you know, possibly a bit too radical to really entertain, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
You know? I'm a dreamer, so I start with really extreme, like, you know, I would love the world to look like this, and then then sort of have to get reeled in from that standpoint. So some of the things that I would really love to you know, for me, like the first step of the first part of the job is I need to like learn a lot. Mm-hmm. So I've had, you know, one-on-one, the great pleasure of having one-on-one, like a masterclass, crash course in like planning law and development and how that works on the ground.
Yeah.
So that's something that I know is a big priority and is coming up. And I don't know enough about it to be the expert. Like, I'm not going to lead that, but I definitely, I can see that while I would love to just be talking about spiders and bats and birds, that I need to understand, like how we can accommodate all sorts of requirements and needs on this island, you know, mm-hmm. Britain, and recognize that, for example, particularly where I live, and I love the fact that I don't live in a media bubble. I live outside of that. So the conversations I have when I'm out and about are one of the parents in my kid's school that, you know, they're farming family. And, you know, this couple genuinely want to try and do things differently and do things better for, you know, both their sort of farm, for wildlife, for their children, all that kind of stuff. They're trying to do a lot with, I would say, a very difficult job. And they talked to me about how they were trying to develop a little like part of the farm where there's some dilapidated barns, and they were trying to do them up so they can rent them out and just generate a bit more income. You know, so these aren't like people who are like rolling in it.
Yeah.
And it turns out that, you know, they had the survey done and there were bats roosting there. So it's cost them like $20,000 to extra to accommodate the changes in order to develop that. So, you know, when I hear that, I'm really aware that it's going to be important to listen to all sides and be really, you know, and it sounds a bit wishy-washy, like, oh, you're going to compromise. No, but I do think it's important to listen. So I think that's going to be one of the first things I would like to do. You know, I'll be very much, you know, like I said, after, I'm assuming, a period of, you know, just learning about the role and like an induction of sorts. I really want to sit and listen to many different perspectives and then try and work out, because I think ultimately that's the kind of person I am. I'm a big empath. So, you know, I don't find it difficult to put myself in other shoes. I don't find it difficult to sit in the in between, the gray area. Yeah. I'm not a black and white thinker. And as I've gone through my work, both as a researcher and all the other hats I wear, what I notice I do a lot is I connect people, and I like kind of making connections and thinking, oh, hang on a second, there's this person on this side of the line and this person on that side of the line, and I think they've got common ground here, and let's try and see what happens if we connect that. So it's early days, but I think, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing how the role evolves. And like I said, you know, there's urgency to it as well.
Yeah.
So it's being really clear that we have to act, like now, but, I would like to, you know, act from a place where I'm really listening, you know, to what's needed, and bring as many people, you know, along for the ride as we possibly can.
Absolutely. It's collaborate and listening. It's always the way forward in every single aspect. We've got to bring them all together. My last question for you, and this might be the hardest one, I'm not sure. Gillian, if you could just pass on one bit of advice to everyone on the planet, so they all hear this, about the natural world, what would you pass on?
I would say slow down. I would say that when you slow down, you notice more. When you slow down, you use less. Yeah. What's the rush? <You know? laughs> I mean, I get it. I'm a single parent. And I know I'm on the telly, so everyone assumes that everything's like lined up and my life's great. But, you know, I feel like I have some like, and have done for many years, you know, real struggles. There's been illnesses in my family. There's all kinds of demands. Yeah. So I find it difficult to slow down myself. So maybe that's why, you know, maybe that's what I really want. I want to slow down.
Are you advising yourself here?
So I'm going to tell everyone else to do it.
well. Please make it the normal.
But honestly, though, we do live at a very fast pace, you know, and sometimes, particularly because, especially in the last 10, 15 years, the world has changed so much and so quickly, and we have adopted as normal things that were not normal even like 5 years ago, let alone 10 years ago. And that rate of change seems to be getting faster and faster and faster. And I think that's why I feel like it is worth saying slow down, like just across the board, because things are getting faster. And that's not just this kind of feeling. It's you know, it's an observable, measurable phenomenon. And I think I remember listening to a talk by Kevin Fong, who's a presenter, a science communicator, amazing and very, very clever man, who he's done like number of PhDs. He sort of was an astrophysicist, then he switched to aeronautical engineering, decided none of that was quite what he wanted to do. So then he did he did medicine, became a doctor, and then specialized in extreme medicine. So, you know, I'm saying all that just to say he's quite clever. He's clearly someone who is into his tech and his science and his technology and all that stuff. And I remember listening to a talk where he was just racing through 100 years of medical innovation. And he ended the talk saying that one of the things that he thinks that he, you know, as a doctor, he's most concerned about now is people feeling disaffected and people feeling like, you know, this kind of pandemic. He didn't use the word, but I guess that's what he was getting at. This widespread wholesale feeling of lack of purpose, of anxiety, of depression. Like, we're not happy people generally.
Yeah.
And he was suggesting in his talk that one of the reasons is that the rate of change in terms of the infrastructure and the technology around us has increased so fast that as biological beings, we cannot keep up with it anymore.
Wow.
So that is why I think slow down is my, you know, catch-all phrase right now in terms of like, you want some advice, slow down. See if it works. If it doesn't, that's okay. Speed up again, but just try it.
Yeah. I think that's perfect advice going into the month that we are in and going into the change that we are in from post-lockdown into Christmas. The attitude is going to be like, right, get everything done. It's like, just do it nice and slowly, look after yourselves, and have a good time.
Exactly.
Gillian, thank you so much for being on an episode of Into the Wild. It's been an absolute joy to talk to you today, and again, congratulations with the Wildlife Trust, and I cannot wait to see it develop in time. And yeah, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I wish you the best for the last month, and have a very merry Christmas, and let's hope 2021 is a slight bit different.
Yeah, let's hope. Yeah. Thank you so much, Ryan. That's great. Enjoy myself.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and work Gillian is working on, you can do so on Instagram and Twitter at @Gillians_voice. Don't forget you can get in touch with me at intothewildpod@gmail.com or on social media at intothewildpod on Twitter and intothewildpodcast on Instagram. Whether you just want to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or let me know what you want to hear about next year. But, as promised, a quick message, and I mean quick. This year has been... I mean, I'm not even going to go there. But for Into the Wild, it's been a hell of a journey. We've presented 36 episodes, talking to 41 experts around the world about so many topics. We've spoken about beavers, birds, so many birds, corals, trophy hunting, flies, social insects, sharks, diversity in nature, the list goes on for about 36 episodes. We've even started a mini series about plants, and so far we've released 2 episodes with many more to come. And now we've got a partnership, an amazing company that is behind us, helping us to build the show even more. But I'm just a one-man band. I do everything myself. So why do I use the word we? Because I include you in that. Yeah, you. Without you pressing play, downloading these episodes, tweeting about the shows, Instagram in them, I would just be some lanky ginger guy in his North London flat wanting to connect with nature. So for that, from the bottom of my heart, thank you. 2021, I hope, brings change we all need. And I can say with confidence, it definitely will for Into the Wild. We have lots, and I mean lots, to look forward to. For now, I'm taking a 2-week Christmas break to relax and enjoy some mince pies, and I urge you all to do the same. Merry Christmas, you nature nerds and wildlife warriors, and until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.